You're listening to a podcast of spurious morality. Yes, he did let me back in.
You broke back in. You're still holding the crowbar. There's alarms going off. Hello and welcome to a podcast of spurious morality. I'm Johnston, and with me this week for the first time in absolutely flipping ages is Connor. Hello, Connor.
Hello.
And we're doing a coffee bar episode because it's been a while, because we kind of stopped doing any episodes that weren't talking about new Doctor Who, and we love doing coffee bar episodes because we love talking about not just Doctor Who, other things as well. We've been listening to loads of great stuff between us, and it feels like we've built up a bit of a backlog of things that we want to talk about. So this is just going to be something along the lines of an hour of us just gushing about wonderful audiobooks, audio drama, that kind of thing, and various other things too. Because we're going to talk a little bit about Doctor Who Series 2, because we've not heard you talk about it yet, Connor. Well, it may be the listeners at home don't hear you talk about it at all, as I have to apply so many censorship beeps.
I have opinions.
Yes, let's do that. Let's do that first then. So, okay. our wonderful listeners have heard me talk about the new series in its entirety. I was there for every episode on this podcast, so we've broken it down episode by episode. We've gone through everything. The dust has settled. It's been a few weeks now, and I still sort of have thoughts and feelings that have processed. I still think it was a great series overall. I really, really do. But I think those last two episodes have soured the whole thing a little bit for me. They weren't necessarily bad. I think they were just sort of thrown together in not the way that was intended, and it all went a bit wrong. And I think it would have been quite good if we'd have got what we were supposed to have, but you know, it happens. It's not the first time Doctor Who has been disrupted by whatever's going on behind the scenes, so here we are. I enjoyed most of the series, even if the finale two-parter kind of didn't quite work for me.
I think that's its biggest problem, really, isn't it? Like, it was such a good run, and I was really, really into it, certainly more than I was last year. But like that little run between Lux and the Interstellar Song Contest, it's the best little, you know, it's the best little chunk of Doctor Who that we've had for a couple of years. The likes of The Well, I thought it was fantastic. It was just a proper old school Doctor Who story. Couple of nice surprises in it. And I really, really enjoyed it. I think Shudi Gatwa got his best scene. Actually, I definitely think he was always very good, but a big improvement from him even over his performance last year. Like, I think one of my favourite scenes from him is him confronting Conrad in the TARDIS at the end of Lucky Day. Now, obviously, more came after that with Conrad, but at the time, I sort of thought that's a really, really good... There was a bit more steel in the Doctor this year, which I liked, between him standing up to Conrad, and it definitely went too far in the Interstellar Song Contest, with him confronting the people who sort of, it was the guy, I have forgotten their names, unfortunately, but it was the guy in the control room who took over the station. It was the bit where he was talking to him over the video link, And I was like, you've put ice in my heart. And I'd like, that's we haven't seen that side of this Doctor before. And it's really, really good. Shooty's fantastic at it. Ultimately did go far too far. I did not enjoy the Doctor turning into a torturer, effectively, towards the end of that one. But overall, really, really good run of stories. And then you get to the finale. And Wishworld, they said, on release, was a little bit of a stinker. It completely mishandled the whole alternate reality thing for me, in that the Doctor and Belinda are both so passive. And Ruby gets to be the one who's doing all the questioning, but Ruby's not a main character anymore. And the, you know, the two stars of the series are completely sidelined for nearly the whole episode. Archie Punjabi was great as the Rani. I'm still disappointed that Mrs. Flood, or what I was and remain very disappointed that Mrs. Flood was sidelined by her, but she was, Archie Punjabi herself was a really fantastic Rani. Reality War, I actually enjoyed, but I don't think that should be confused for it being good. I had fun with it in a sort of Wishworld has put my expectations in the ground, and I'm just going to sit back and have fun with whatever rubbish this is. And I did, in fairness, and it was helped massively by the keys being jangled in my face in the form of Jodie Whittaker turning up again, because that little scene between her and Shooty was fantastic. Really, really flipping good to see Jodie Whittaker again. And I did not actually realise how much I missed her until she appeared and we got to see her running around that new TARDIS set. And she looked right at home on it. I enjoyed the wee detail of her being able to better program the TARDIS to do what Shooty's Doctor wanted it to do than he could himself, because she was more of an engineer. I really, really enjoyed that scene. That was absolutely, I think that's the highlight of the Russell T Davies to the RTD2 era for me, was that little bit where Jodie Whittaker turned up, because it was just so good and I really miss her. And then you get to the very end and the regeneration happens, and it's like, if Billy, see, this is the thing, Billy Piper, if she hadn't been a companion, if she hadn't been Rose Tyler, she would absolutely be on your list to play the Doctor. But the problem is, we're back to playing in that sort of remember 2005, remember 2006 sandbox again. And Doctor Who's completely incapable of moving onwards, apparently, anymore. I sound very grumpy about it, and I'm not, and I'm actually quite detached from it, but it was a bit rubbish.
I think detached is the right word, actually, because I'm kind of feeling, throughout the whole series, I was saying I actually felt a lot more connected to Doctor Who than I had for a long time. I was really enjoying the series. I was really looking forward to next week. And then the finale just seemed to slap me right back out of it. And all of a sudden, I'm like, big finish is my Doctor Who again. I've been far more excited about the Eighth Doctor Time War set that's come out in the last week. You know, I've been looking forward to that far more than anything else, because I'm really interested and invested in sort of what's going on with Cass and Hieronymus Friend, fantastic character, and all this kind of thing. And that's just kind of where I feel I am at the moment. Like, oh, no, I've Telly Doctor Who's suddenly gone back to not being my Doctor Who again. I'm jumping back to audio Doctor Who as kind of my main source of Doctor Who enjoyment. And it shouldn't be. I should be absolutely raving about how good that series was, because it was.
I know. And I think, do you know what? Because it's all been so connected, I feel like the finale being as disappointing as it was sort of reflects back over Shooty's era as such, because he really went out in such a damp squib. And I think everyone at this point has heard the behind-the-scenes gossip and rumours about you know, him leaving early and the finale being reshot to accommodate a regeneration scene that wasn't planned, you know, and it all being done very last minute. I think it's a real shame for him that his story ended this way. But it does reflect badly on the whole era, because I think it's very, very clear on screen in a way that it shouldn't be just how much the wheels came off this era. I think they were really hamstrung the minute Millie Gibson stepped back. And I actually don't like speculation on why that was, because none of us talking about it on the outside were there. We don't know what went on behind the scenes. Clearly it wasn't an unhappy split, because she came back to do season two. You know, if she wasn't happy, I'm quite certain she wouldn't have come back after she left in season one. But it's clear that not everything was perfect, otherwise she would have stayed on. And again, I don't like speculation on the reasons behind that, but I think it is very clear that the minute that she did step back, or it was agreed that she would step back and not be a lead character anymore, that they were very hamstrung with their plans for season two. I think Varada Sethu and Belinda were very hard done by in the end. She was completely wasted, if I'm being honest. I don't think they made nearly as good a use of the character and the actress as they could have done. And it sounds like she was brought on very last minute. Like, I think she got the script for The Robot Revolution about a fortnight before recording started, if I remember rightly. And it all feels like such a waste. For her and for, like, we got Carol Ann Ford back, and it hasn't come to anything yet. Now, you know, sure, it might come to something, but I think we know that there is some footage that was shot with Carol Ann Ford as Susan Foreman that didn't make it to screen, which is, it's absolutely scandalous.
Yes.
Like, how the hell did that happen?
I honestly don't know. Like, it's... I mean, obviously, you know, we don't know what's going on with this Disney deal. But what we do know is that there was an agreement for a certain episode count, and so many of those episodes have been assigned to The War Between the Land and Sea.
Yes.
And while I'm all for Doctor Who spin-off series, we should have Doctor Who spin-off series. I'll never forget how good it was when we had Doctor Who and Torchwood and Sarah Jane all at the same time. It was amazing. But, like, if there was any indication whatsoever that this was the episode count, could we just have made it all Doctor Who? Could we have actually signed Chuty up for three seasons, shot them all back to back if necessary, and just had three seasons of Doctor Who that gave his Doctor the arc that was so obviously being set up in those last few episodes? It really felt as though the character was starting to go somewhere. And like you say, there was Susan and all these other things. It's also scandalous that Ruby never got a proper goodbye with this Doctor. Like, he literally just goes, "See ya," and walks into the TARDIS while she's stood with like 15 other people.
And she's not in The War Between the Land and the Sea, is she?
I don't believe so.
Not as far as we know. Yeah, I think I'm glad there's a spin-off, and it makes sense for this era that it would be Unit that gets the spin-off. But again, this hasn't come from anything. You know, you look back at Torchwood and the Sarah Jane Adventures, and those were proper spin-offs in that Sarah Jane Smith was in the main show with K-9. She got a spin-off. Captain Jack was in the main series. Torchwood was in the main series. That got a spin-off. This feels slightly more akin to Class, where it was sort of bolted on to Doctor Who from the outside and made to fit in with the continuity of Doctor Who, I think. Rather than being like an organically spun off, this is a popular part of the main show, let's give it its own thing. I think it's a sort of weird halfway house between the war with The War Between the Land and Sea, where this is going to be about Unit, But Kate Stewart's not a main character. The Sea Devils haven't been in the main show for, you know, around the Jodie Whittaker era, but it was one
episode. I'd say it's only a few years.
This has nothing to do with it, you know.
No.
It's a complete redesign. It's its own thing. I think it does have links to Torchwood by the looks of it, because there's at least one Torchwood character coming back in it. One of the generals from Children of Earth is in it. Colin McFarlane is back playing the same character from Torchwood. So I think that's cool. And I'm absolutely going to watch it. Don't get me wrong. But I think it's really strange that we're sitting here currently with no idea of what's going to happen to the show. Now, obviously the Disney deal hasn't worked out in the end, and that's being peddled back on now. By the looks of it, I have heard rumors that there's other streamers, you know, being talked to. I won't get into spoilers and speculation, because I never know if these things are true or not. I've said it's stuff that's out on social media, but it sounds like there's a version of Doctor Who that whatever this new potential partner is that they want to make, and then there's the version that the BBC and Bad Wolf want to keep making. And I actually prefer the sound of the streamers version, and I would be quite happy if that got made instead. But I don't think that will happen, because obviously Doctor Who rests with the BBC and, for the time being, with Bad Wolf. But from what I've heard, the streamers' pitch for what they would do with Doctor Who is much more exciting and much more in line with what I would want than what we're currently getting, and what it sounds like the BBC and Bad Wolf want to keep making.
I mean, there should be a happy medium. One of the great things about Doctor Who is it can be anything. So it can be a bit of A and a bit of B and still work very, very well. It wouldn't be the first time Doctor Who had like a meshing of styles, like a very, very different producer and script editor or whatnot. So I don't know.
I don't know. I sound very negative on all this, and I'm negative on where we've ended up, but I'm actually quite detached from the TV series at the moment.
I'm not quite enjoying the no news thing, and they're teasing it as if it's going on. You know, it's going to continue, and then immediately following it up with, but we don't know if it's going to continue or not. Like, right, could we have just not done the Billy Piper thing, and could we have just ended it like the War Games, where we don't see who the next Doctor is, and then could literally plonk any actor in front of us at some point further down the line?
The Billy Piper thing, I think it feels like desperation, like we've done a big shock, you know, stunt casting surprise, please keep watching, please keep funding us, sort of thing. And
well, it's exactly the what the hell's going on here thing that we got at the end of Power of the Doctor with David Tennant reappearing.
Yes.
And it's literally the same thing. It's not even like it. It's just the same thing. And ironically, that never really got explained. All the questions we were asking then, you know, why is his clothes regenerated with him? Why has this happened? Why has that happened? Why does he look like David Tennant again? I know that was sort of flimsily hand-waved in a bit of dialogue, but there could have been something really interesting going on there, and we never got it. Don't get me wrong, I'm glad, you know, David Tennant was 14. That was a lot of fun. That was good. It worked for the specials. It was a good idea, but it kind of set up a lot of questions because of the way it was handled beforehand. And the same thing's happening here. Like, you know, is Billy Piper the Doctor? Big question mark. I don't know. Anyway, we've done 20 minutes of Doctor Who on our not Doctor Who episode. Should we do something else?
I know. It was the Twin Dilemma last time. Let's not do the Twin Dilemma again.
So they could just remake The Twin Dilemma with Billy Piper.
No, I'll just stop watching. Shall we talk about our favourite series?
The whole point of this episode is that we're going to talk about things that aren't Doctor Who, that we have been listening to, watching, reading, whatever. I know we've both, sort of separately actually, been listening to a series that I have mentioned on one of these Coffee Bar episodes before. But you've started it, and I think you've actually overtaken me with it now, because I do it as kind of one every few months and you seem to be quite on board with it. But that's the Charles Parris Mysteries.
Yes. Do we need to explain what the Charles Parris Mysteries are?
Because Bill Nighy plays an actor, middle-aged, drinks a bit too much, solves murders. There we go. Done.
That's it. That's the whole series. Do you know what I like? The reason I like it so much is that it can entirely replace Doctor Who for me. Like, I listen to Big Finish, you know, I tend to have a four-parter on the go at any one time, and I listen to an episode a day. It's the same format with Charles Parris. You get, you know, a two-hour serial split into four parts, 30-minute episodes. I love that. I really love that style. And this just perfectly, whenever I need a break from Big Finish, I can put Charles Parris on for a little run and listen to him. And it's really, really good. Really satisfying.
Great character as well. And Bill Nighy is just wonderful. You know, there were rumours that Bill Nighy was going to be the Doctor once. I'd have been all over that. That'd have been great. But no, he's absolutely great as Charles Parris, who sort of just kind of drinks and acts cynical and ends up solving the murder, almost by accident in some cases. But it's more
he can't help himself but get involved. That's the thing as well. Like, he knows he's only an amateur. He's not even an amateur sleuth. He's just a guy who happens to get involved with these cases as they happen around him. And he can't resist just being nosy and trying to solve it, you know, while the police are fumbling around in the background.
Yeah, they're an awful lot of fun. They're definitely sort of based in comedy. They're not out-and-out comedies, but there's a very sort of solid and consistent humour all the way through that that works really well. Like, it's not your usual tone for a amateur sleuthy type adventure. You know, a lot of them are whimsy, but not many of them are actually funny. And I think that's what sets this apart. There are some genuinely funny moments.
There's quite a dry, dark humour to it at times, and sort of a lot of it comes out in this sort of very understated, witty back and forth between him and Morris, or him and Francis, his wife, who are the only other two sort of main characters who appear every episode without fail. So I think it comes out there. Like, it's not out and out comedy, but it's just that little bit of dry wit between those Charles and his wife and Charles and his agent. And it's really funny. It reminds me a lot. I constantly compare the series as a whole. It's very like New Tricks. It's that sort of style, that sort of humor. And it's very, very easy to listen to.
Yeah, it's not something you have to concentrate sort of too heavily on. It's more than background listening. Like, you want to listen to it, but it's definitely not something you need to listen to over and over again to get it to make sense, as is the case with, you know, a fair amount of audio Doctor Who.
Yes, absolutely. Do you have a favourite? This is the thing. I can remember the stories, but I can never place them with the titles. I remember, like, the vampire film one where he's playing a vampire in a film, or I remember the one where he's a detective in a series, or there's quite a lot of Shakespeare. They seem to come back to Shakespeare and plays quite a fair bit from what I've heard. I haven't heard them all, but I've heard the first two collections now, and it seems to have, like, you occasionally get him doing a film or a series, but it's mostly on stage.
Yes. So I'm now listening to them in order, and I think I'm at roughly the same place as you are. But I still think my favourite is actually the first one that I listened to, which is A Reconstructed Corpse, where he's taking part in a sort of crime watch reconstruction style thing, and somebody gets murdered on that. That was an awful lot of fun. Some great humour, and one of the episodes ends, and it's some of the most brilliant sort of directed audio drama I've heard, where he kind of discovers a body and he walks into a room, and there a person in the room who's dead was listening to Pink Floyd's Great Gig in the Sky. So you've got that on in the background, and you've just got sort of Charles narrating what he sees as he walks in and as he discovers this body, and it's just so fantastically put together. In fact, one of the real, real strengths of it is its use of real sort of 60s, 70s rock music. There's not much, if anything at all, actually, in the way of original soundtrack. It's all archival, very recognizable music as well. Yeah. Stuff, you know, it's Pink Floyd's, Rolling Stones, Kinks, and the Kinks all that turn sort up of
a
thing. Lot.
20th Century Boy made a couple of appearances in the last couple I was listening to, and it's I like that those songs have survived the transfer, because I'm not listening to these on the radio. I'm listening to them on, there's a collection that they've been sorted into collections now on Spotify, and that's the version I'm listening to. But the songs are still there, like they've kept the music, when it probably would have been quite easy to replace that for the commercial release versus the one on the radio. So I like that, that has survived the transfer from radio to CD and download as well.
Yeah, it's. I think it's sort of an integral part of it. I really don't think it would work half as well without these absolutely fantastic musical choices. And yeah, it really does sort of enhance the whole thing. I bet it's sort of a copyright minefield to release it outside of the radio. But like you say, it's worth the fact that they've gone to the effort to make that happen.
Yes. So you talked about A Reconstructed Corpse. It was in my head as well, because that very same cliffhanger is one of the very few parts of the series that actually genuinely manages to shock you. Because that's the same cliffhanger. He finds the body in the bathroom, and then he comes out and goes into the kitchen, and he finds the head in the fridge. And it's not the head of the person you're expecting. It's actually the head of the prime suspect in the murder he's investigating. So there's the main victim, and he thinks it's this other guy. He thinks it's the retired private detective, I think. And it's his head he finds in the fridge. And it, oh my God, my jaw. It's the one time I think the series has managed to actually shock me. It was really, really effective.
I think it's very deliberately a very predictable series, but it does that so it can occasionally do exactly what you've just described. It can throw something at you that's genuinely not predictable, and it's genuinely quite surprising. And it does sort of have a slightly bigger impact as a result.
Yes, yes. So I think the first one I heard was, it's in the third collection, actually. I'm going to look up the title of it now. It was A Doubtful Death, which is set in Oxford. And it's quite funny because there's loads of wee recommendations, there's loads of wee sort of references to what's going on at the current time. They've been recording these for years. Yeah. So the references, you can tell when an episode was recorded just by the references it makes. Like there's a string of them, must have been made 2008, 2009, 2010, because felt like every episode for a wee while there was talk of, oh, the financial crisis sort of thing. That turns up a lot. But A Doubtful Death, it was the first one I heard. It was quite recent. Set in Oxford. he's in a play, but he really, really wants a part in Endeavor. So you're getting that sort of thing where there's loads of nice wee references to other things. I think it's A Doubtful Death as well, where he's really itching to get a proper high profile role, because he never gets a proper high profile role. It's all wee small projects, or he's always quite disappointed with the work he gets, and it's very funny then when he's talking to Morris, his agent. But Morris has a habit of giving him like one word hints. Like there's one where he talks about the Woody project, and you're meant to think it's like a big Hollywood thing, and then it turns out it's actually he's talking about him playing Woody in a Bay City Rollers play or documentary or something like that. There's one where he talks about Morris tells him, he says, "I've got you a new job," and it's Potter, and he thinks he's going to be in, Charles thinks he's going to be in Harry Potter, and it turns out it's like, I can't remember, it's like a Dennis Potter play or something like that, but it's nowhere near the profile that Morris has been leading them on to think it is. I think Morris is my favourite character. I always get quite happy when I hear his little ringtone playing on Charles's phone.
Absolutely fantastic character, yeah. Just sort of constantly setting him up to fail, and somehow they all come out of it quite well. And I imagine actually a fairly accurate portrayal of a theatrical agent as well.
Yes. I wouldn't be surprised. I actually really enjoy The Dead Side of the Mic as well, which is the one where he gets into the BBC's radio drama rep department for a little bit, and he's doing all these plays. I quite like that because it feels a bit meta that you're listening to a radio play and the actor is working for the same department that made the radio play. I think that's quite good. But there's a couple of really fun wee cameos in there where Charlotte Green turns up playing herself. And I think there's a couple of other BBC people, you know, voicing themselves in the background, that sort of thing. So it's I really enjoyed it. It was a bit of a standout because, like, as I say, it's usually Charles in a play on stage. Sometimes you get a TV series, sometimes you get a film. This felt a wee bit out of the ordinary where he was doing a wee stint in the BBC's radio drama department.
Yeah, I think they had a lot of fun making that one. You get the impression. These were all based on books as well. And I've never read any of the books. Have you at all?
I haven't. And no. This is the thing, I work in a bookshop. I've gone looking for them, but I don't know whether... I think the books are still being released, actually. I think it's still an ongoing series. But I think the earlier ones have possibly gone out of print. I keep meaning to track some of them down. I don't know. I get the impression that they're quite different from the radio series.
Yeah.
Because I think they're a little more serious. I don't think the humor's there just as much. You certainly don't have Bill Nye, and Bill Nye it's almost a vehicle for him. Like, I think a lot of what we like about Charles comes from him rather than comes from the character. He certainly makes Charles on paper shouldn't be a very likable character, but Bill Nye makes him so. I think that's fair to say. But I must try and track him down. Am I right in saying he's not the first person to play Charles Paris? Because I think these books were published in the 1980s, or the first ones were coming out in the 1980s. And I think there was two or three done with a different actor playing Charles back at the start.
I think you might be right. I believe that in its sort of current incarnation, the first one was done as a live recording at something like Edinburgh Fringe or something like that.
Okay.
I can't remember, and I did read about this a while ago. So the first one was done as a live recording with Bill Nye, as far as I can remember. And then it kind of got picked up as a radio series after that. And I think the one that they recorded live has actually been redone, because when it was done originally, the whole thing was half an hour long, and it's been redone in the four-part format that the rest of them are.
I couldn't tell you which. I just looked up here, actually. So the first two were made in 1984 and 1985. The first one was cast in Order of Disappearance, and the second was So Much Blood. And Francis Matthews played the lead in that one. Francis Matthews, I knew I recognized him, actually. He was the voice of Captain Scarlet in the original series. And he also played Paul Temple on TV. And that would be another big BBC radio series as well, the Paul Temple Mysteries. So that's quite cool. I didn't realize that was him. I must track those down as well because I quite like Captain Scarlet. Bill Nye's first one was, you're quite right, recorded on location at the Edinburgh Fringe setting. And it was done in 1999.
Well, there we go. And which one was it?
It was another. It was a remake of So Much Blood.
Yes.
And then, so I didn't realize it was the first one, actually. The first one I heard was a series of murders, and it seems to have been the first of, like, the series. So they made So Much Blood with Bill Nye, by the looks of it, like, as one-off at the Edinburgh Fringe. And then when it became a, not a series as such, but it was a different author adapted it, Jeremy Front. The first one he did, he has done them all, I think, since this. The first one he did was a series of murders, and that was when it became like a recurring thing then.
And it's one of these that they do like once a year, once every couple of years. They'll just occasionally, so. Yeah.
I didn't realize there was one on in February, and I missed it on the radio. I think it's been released now as a download.
Yeah, I've got it subscribed on BBC Sounds, so it does pop up whenever there's something new, but that doesn't necessarily mean I've caught the new one. If I know for a fact, yes. I haven't. But it's a lot of fun. It's worth listening to. The only thing I will say is, and I think this is something we both found, they can get a little bit samey if you try to binge them. This is yes. Not a bingeable series. There's a reason the BBC are doing one a year. There's a reason we get four episodes a year or thereabouts. Because if you do them all at the same time, you start to feel deja vu very quickly.
There's two in the second collection where he bumps into an old friend and his old friend turns out to be the suspect. And they're one after the other and you're like, this is very samey. I did think the second collection I didn't struggle with as much in that regard, but I don't know whether that's any difference in the stories or whether that's because I was a bit more prepared going into them for them to be so samey. So I think you probably have the right way of listening just once every now and then. But you're right, they're very similar.
It's one of those things that just kind of plugs a gap in my listening. So they're very useful. For example, say I know there's a new Big Finish coming out the next day and I've just finished what I was listening to before, so I need something to tide me over until the new release. It's an easy sort of hour and a half, 2 hours, isn't it? That kind of thing.
Yes.
So it just kind of, yeah, it just fills, when I've got nothing else to listen to or when I'm expecting something else, it's the perfect thing to just throw on and have a bit of fun with. I do have another sort of thing that kind of serves that purpose as well. And this is a podcast that I've been listening to. Has finished now, drama podcast. It has finished now, it finished a couple of years ago, but it's called The Offensive. And it's basically the thick of it meets Premier League football. And it's so much fun. It's just basically the dodgy, corrupt backroom staff of a fictitious Premier League football club, arguing, falling out, trying to manage the press, trying to screw each other over, stabbing each other in the back. It's genuinely funny, and it's not particularly subtle with the thick of it link. Like, there's an enforcer type character with a thick Scottish accent who swears all the time. They're not even trying to pretend he's not football's Malcolm Tucker. But as a huge fan of the thick of it, this series really works. And there's a good couple of hundred episodes. It had five series, and basically each episode is another week in the Premier League calendar. So, like commentaries on fictitious matches and all that kind of thing are a fairly big part of it. Really, really funny stuff, though. Really enjoyable. Some genuine laugh-out-loud moments and sort of the creative, sweary wordplay that you got in the thick of it's all there as well. So it's not a subtle rip-off, but it's a very good one.
I have also been trying to sort of build more variance into my listening. So it was just solely Big Finish and almost entirely Doctor Who for a long time, but I've been trying to branch out a little bit recently. There's a lot of good stuff on Radio 4's just drama on 4, like one-off plays. There's been some really good ones in there. There was one about Hillian Hanf that I heard recently, and Hillian Hanf is sort of the bookworm's bookworm. She was the author of 84 Charing Cross Road, which is just, it's a collection of letters between her and a bookshop owner in London. She lived in New York, and she wrote to an antiquarian bookshop in London to try and source some old secondhand out of print books. And they had a 20-year friendship. They never met in person because Frank, the bookseller, sadly died before she was able to get to England. But the play I heard was sort of the story of her life. She was a writer. She wanted to write a play for Broadway, and I don't think she ever managed it. But she did end up, she was one of the earliest television writers in the United States, while TV was still very prominently made in New York, sort of before it moved out to Los Angeles and the other, you know, the West Coast. So that was really, really good. There was one about J.B. Priestley trying to get A Gentleman Calls put on in London. And I really enjoy A Gentleman Calls. As it would be one of my very favourite plays. So that was quite good listening to that. I think Rory Kinnear plays him and it's really, really good. I don't listen to everything that goes out under that strand. I sort of pick and choose what I enjoy. There was quite a good one with Derek Jacobi playing Laurence Olivier, giving Margaret Thatcher sort of performance lessons. I don't know whether or not that's based on a true story, but it's a really good play. I quite enjoyed it. So there's a lot of good stuff on there that's worth picking up. Just a one-off, you know, if I've run out of Big Finish that I've, you know, want to listen to, or I need a bit of a change, it's nice to be able to go on and get something. They're usually either 45 minutes or an hour, and I think the 45-minute ones are just quite a nice length that you're not stuck listening to something for a full hour. It's just, it's nice and quick by comparison. So there's some quite good stuff on there.
I've been doing some sort of longer listens recently as well, because a lot of what I listen to, you know, like you, and you know, in the past, there's been a lot of Big Finish, a lot of Doctor Who, and you know, I'm not letting that go. I'm still subscribed to, well, I still have the bundle for everything coming out this year, and still grabbing pretty much anything that is sort of Doctor Who linked or Blake Seven linked or that I fancy. But I've been going for some sort of longer audio books as well. And one that sort of stood out to me recently was I started listening to The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, and sort of mentioned in our group chat that I was doing so. And it was actually Mansour pointed out there's a sort of alternative version online you can buy of the Andy Serkis reading Hobbit and Lord of the Rings audiobooks. They've been soundtracked. So this is full immersive. There's music, there's atmosphere, there's sound effects, and it just works with the narration. So you kind of, you go on the website, you buy whatever soundscape you want. They're not cheap, but we are talking about, in the case of Lord of the Rings, it's more or less 60 hours worth of material that accompanies the audiobook. So you're given everything you need, you go on, you buy it, download it. There's an app that will merge the audiobook file with the soundscape file. And it was just fantastic. fantastic to listen to. Like the amount of thought and time and work that must have gone into this, you know, enhancing what is a, you know, obviously very gripping and very well known story, Lord of the Rings. Everyone knows and loves Lord of the Rings. But being able to enhance those audiobooks, indeed, just being brave enough to even attempt that's fantastic. So, if you're interested in finding this sort of thing, Jordan Rennells, I hope I'm saying that correctly, give that a Google, and there's a huge list of soundscapes. I mean, there's all sorts there. It's not just Lord of the Rings. There's the Song of Ice and Fire books, the Wheel of Time books, various other things, and they've all, it's an ongoing project, so there's more and more stuff being announced all the time. I've kind of signed up to the newsletter, which you get every now and again, and I am going to get more of these, and I'm going to listen to more audiobooks with these. Like, I definitely think I'm due a go at Song of Ice and Fire. I read them all when Game of Thrones very first started as a series, but I think that's an audiobook project I'd like to do at some point, and I definitely think it would be worth doing this soundscape version. So, absolutely fantastic work. Like, I really, really can't begin to even start to sing the praises of this thing in a way that does it justice, because, like I say, it's almost beyond my comprehension how somebody has managed to produce something so good and so engaging and 60 hours long to accompany a reading of a book. It's just utterly brilliant.
I recently tried to read The Hobbit, and I didn't get very far in, unfortunately. I wasn't doing it as audio, I was doing a paperback. And there was something I couldn't quite manage to get into. It was a group of friends and I have been doing a wee book club, and that was our first one. We're going to do The Midnight Library by Matt Haig next. But I really like the sound of that. As you said, it sounds like a momentous project. But the thought of, like, I struggle with audiobooks versus audio plays, because I think having one reader, I think it's very easy for me to tune out of, you know, and stop paying attention. Whereas there's a bit more going on with a radio play that sort of holds my attention more easily. Not all the time, but usually. I really like the sound of that. It sounds very interesting. It sounds like it's a beautiful end product. With the music, and Andy Serkis, I'm sure, is a fantastic narrator. So I could see myself giving those a go at some point down the line.
I mean, I know I've just sung the praise of this thing, but Andy Serkis as narrator, just excellent. Every single character comes to life. Like, you can listen to these on their own, and he is just such an engaging reader that actually you don't need the soundscape, but the soundscape just elevates it to a whole other level. And honestly, it's the standard that audiobooks should be made to, really, at this point. You know, audiobooks have become such a huge thing in the last few years, really, sort of the rise of Audible and Spotify getting stuck in with it, various other things. It feels like audiobooks are much bigger and much more accessible than they've ever been. And I have so much listening time commuting to and from work and this kind of thing. I can get through quite a lot quite quickly. So taking on, you know, something to listen to like that, it's just great. And it's just absolutely brilliant that people are finding ways of enhancing audiobooks and building on them. And I've talked about Star Wars ones on here before. Like, the Star Wars ones are always excellent. They're always sort of big productions. You have the music, you have the sound effects, you just that extra little bit to just immerse you in it, because it's very, very easy to lose your way with an audiobook. You know, no matter how engaging your reader is, it's very easy to kind of lose your way on one. That being said, I've listened to a few Rebus novel audiobooks, so Ian Rankin books. I've listened to the first sort of, I've just started number three. And they are, feels bad to call them bare bones, but you know what I mean? It's literally a narrator, James McPherson in this case, reading the book. But he does such a good job that, again, I'm in, I'm hooked. I'm not struggling to keep up with it. I wonder what it is. Like, you know, I've never been able to pinpoint it. Kind of, what is it about an audiobook reader that keeps me so engaged where others don't? I'm very curious because I don't think it's a performance thing. I don't think it's nothing to do with accents or anything like that. It's genuinely sort of interesting to consider what it is that holds my attention better than other stuff. Do you find the same thing, or is it just me being weird?
So in terms of audiobook narrators, when I'm doing an audiobook, I'll tend to listen to more non-fiction, particularly biographies. And if I'm listening to a biography, I quite like, or I much prefer, rather, if it's read by the author or the person who, you know, the biography is about, rather than somebody else. So the likes of that would be, I listen to Prince Harry's Spare, and he reads it himself, and it's much better for it. You know, I've skimmed through the text and the paperback version. I don't think I would have enjoyed that nearly as much as if I had read it, or if someone else had read it, rather than me listening to it in his own voice. There's also the, I think it's Love from the Pink Palace. And oh my God, I've forgotten her name, but it's Russell T Davies' friend who sort of inspired a lot of It's a Sin. And she sort of went, after the series was such a success, she wrote her own memoirs and she reads it herself, and it's much better. She's not the perfect narrator. You know, you can hear there's the very odd slip up now and then, and that's me pointing that out sounds like I'm detracting from the book, but it's actually a real feature because she's telling her own story, rather than somebody else telling, you know, speaking her words. It's a real virtue to that one. I've heard others where it's not the subject of the book. It's somebody else has read it and they're nowhere near as good. So I think that's a big plus for nonfiction. Whereas if someone has written their book, I like hearing it in their voice. In terms of fiction, I did, I think I've mentioned it on here before. It's C.J. Tudor's The Drift. It's very Stephen King. She would get compared to Stephen King quite a lot, and very deservedly so. Her book, The Drift, is told from three different points of view. So the audiobook has three different narrators who sort of voice the point of view characters in those three strands. And Richard Armitage voices one of them, and he's excellent. He's really, really good. My only complaint with that novel was that I'm pretty sure there was one character who is in all three strands, but you don't know it until near the end. And all three narrators gave him a different accent. So that didn't quite work out in that one. I'm pretty sure that was the case, thinking back. I haven't heard it for a little while, but I remember thinking that at the time. It's just like, that's the same person. They should, at the very least, like, one plays him English, one plays him American. And it's things like that. So Richard Armitage was very good in that. I think it just comes down to, do you like the sound of this person's voice? Sometimes I really enjoy, from a Doctor Who point of view, Peter Purvis would be my narrator of choice. I'm very, very happy to listen to Short Trips and Companion Chronicles where he's the narrator. Maureen O'Brien's excellent as well, but there's just something about Purvis's voice that I can settle into and pay attention to. In a way that I can't quite with some other narrators. I think he's excellent. So I don't know what it is. I think there's some time. I think it just ultimately comes down to, is there, does this person have the quality of voice that I enjoy listening to? And I'm, you know, that can hold my attention then.
Yeah, I think you've got an excellent point. Another thing I've been listening to recently is, well, I've started, and I am still very, very at the beginning, really, but I've started listening to the audiobooks of the Target, Doctor Who Target novelizations. Now, I really haven't read many of these at all. In total, I've probably read about 15 Targets, I think. And most of these were a long, 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 long time ago. So it's essentially a whole new way of sort of experiencing Doctor Who. And I've only done two so far, and that's The Daleks, The Edge of Destruction, Unearthly Child's never been released, apparently recorded, never released, Conversation for Another Time. And both of them so far have been read by William Russell. Now, let's be honest, and I don't want to upset anybody here, The Daleks is overlong and really, really bloody slow in places. It drags, and that is absolutely reflected in the book. Edge of Destruction, it's also a bit boring. It's only two episodes long. It's only 15 minutes long, but it's 50 minutes long. But it can be a pretty boring 50 minutes. And going into Edge of Destruction, I did sort of think this kind of tests the often sort of said thing, which is William Russell could read the phone book and I'd still be entertained. Well, I think Edge of Destruction target novelization is probably the closest we're ever going to get to that. And you know what? First of all, the novelization did expand on the story. It did add a little bit more. There's some really interesting stuff about the TARDIS interior and so on in there that's not in the TV episode. There's definitely been some creative license taken with the adaptation. But William Russell reading it was absolutely brilliant. Like, what a narrator he was. And we're so lucky that we got actually quite a lot of stuff out of him while he was still with us. There's an awful lot of his stuff to listen to. So that's good. And yeah, he's a great narrator, fantastic narrator. But we knew that from Companion Chronicles and Short Trips and Early Adventures and other stuff at Big Finish. But yeah, kept me engaged.
I haven't read it. I love target novels. And it's the whole sort of retro vibe to them that I love. You know, they're tiny, these tiny little paperbacks with gorgeous artwork on the covers. I just really like, I think they're neat. I would love, I haven't read it yet, but I don't know. Do you know what the gimmick with the Romans is? Have you ever seen it?
Is it diary entries or something like that?
It's diary entries, and it's like the book has been assembled from scraps of historical evidence. So it's partial diary entries, letters, documentary sources, stuff like that. It's like an archaeologist has been piecing together the different parts of the story from lots of different sources. So I really want to read it shortly. It's meant to be quite good the way it's done. I think, I can't remember if it's The Edge of Destruction or Black Orchid or one of the other two-part stories, but there's at least one of them that has a higher word count than the target edition of the War Games. And it might be The Edge of Destruction, I'm not sure, but the War Games has a lower page count and word count than one of the two-part
stories. Edge of Destruction was, I think it was still relatively short for a target. So in terms of run times that I've looked at, it did clock in at sort of not long over 3 hours, I think. Whereas I've seen some are 4 or 5 hours. One that I have read and I'm looking forward to getting to, although I'm a long, long way off, Sontaran Experiment, that sort of adds quite a bit to the story, gives Harry a lot more to do. It was adapted by Ian Marta.
I was going to say it was one of his stories, wasn't it? He did Earthshock as well, I think.
Apparently his Invasion is worth having a look at as well, although it's one that I've never read. But again, I'll get to it eventually. But again, I'm never going to sit down and plan to read them. It's just going to be, oh, I've got nothing to listen to. Let's do the next target. And that's how I'm treating it. It's not, yes, a big marathon or anything like that.
I'm quite proud. If I ever meet Christopher Eggleston, it'll have to be the Rose target novel I get him to sign, because I've got Sylvester McCoy's signature in Survival, Paul McGann's in the TV movie, and I quite like the thought of having those three stories with three different doctors sitting side by side on the shelf.
Yeah, that sounds quite cool. It does sound good.
There's new ones coming out, actually. I love that they're still being, you know, I love that they're still coming out. There's a set of four coming out this summer and a set of three in January or February. We don't know what the January, February ones are yet, but this year is, it's the first, no, it's not. It's the first three episodes of season two and Empire of Death, Legend of Ruby Sunday and Empire of Death from the last series.
See, I'd like to think that we end up with, you know, this may be something that, well, will be something that takes years and years and years, but I'd like to think we'd end up with a full set. Like, we've got every single classic story now in some way, shape or form. I kind of hope they go for bingo with post-2005 as well.
I would hope so. I would hope so. They do seem to stick, where possible, to getting the original writer still to come in and do it, although I can't remember the last time that happened. I think the last, well, it probably was Rogue, because I think the writers of Rogue did the Target version as well, which was quite cool. Yeah, I really like them, and I like the new covers as well. I think it was a shame that they lost Anthony Dry, because it was quite nice having his style, but whoever it is now doing the new versions, I think it reminds me of the Sylvester McCoy era covers, the style of art that they've got at the moment, so it's quite nice.
And a lot of the cover art's absolutely fantastic.
Very much
has to be said. Like, having sort of assembled the collection now and got everything together on my server ready to listen to, I had a lot of fun sort of seeking out the artwork and applying all of that, and there's some really nice stuff there that I've never actually stopped and taken the time to look at before. Yeah, it was great stuff. Oh, we've circled back around to Doctor Who, so it's probably time to call it a day. My coffee's gone cold as well, because we're in the coffee bar, remember?
Yeah, we are in the coffee bar.
Yeah, we've actually had something to talk about this time. Normally we sort of ramble on about how you don't like coffee for 20 minutes, but
yeah,
we've had a lot of ground to cover.
I've been sitting here with a pint of ice water because it is so unbearably warm at the moment, and it's empty, so I do need to go and get that refilled.
Well, the warm bubble has burst here, and as we've been recording, it started throwing it down, and I'm slightly worried that I'm going to come to edit this episode and it's going to be very audible.
Just before we started, I had the same rain shower, so it's moved from me to you in the space of this recording.
Like a rubbish wet chuckle, brother.
Well, it's good night from me.
And thank you for listening.
Come on, we had to get the two Rannies joke in there somewhere. That actually, there's the highlight of the whole Russell T Davies era. Just to circle back to where we were at the beginning, the best
the two Rannies joke
in season one and season two. The whole series has just built up to Anita Dobson making a two Rannies joke, and it's my favourite moment. There it is. It was the two Rannies joke. I laughed so loud at that.
And there we go. That's all we needed. That's redeemed the whole series, then.
Has it?
Anyway, before I set Connor off again, we probably had better end it there. But thanks very much for joining me. It's been good catching up and coffee barring, and there's actually stuff that I wanted to talk about that we've not covered, so we're going to have to do another one fairly soon, I'm afraid.
That's fair enough.
I'm sure we can manage. Okay, well, we'll leave it there then. So thanks for joining me, Connor, and we shall return for more spodcasting soon. Goodbye now.
Goodbye, my dears. Goodbye.